Show me the money.
This is the Money Web Be a Better Investor podcast, picking the brains of professional investors on their investment strategies, successes, and mistakes. Your host, Rake Fanica.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Be a Better Investor podcast. My name is Rake van Niekerk, and in this podcast, I speak to leading professional investors about their investment journeys, and we try to understand how they analyze investment opportunities and how they approach investments, especially in their personal capacity. And the idea is to identify a few golden nuggets of wisdom to assist amateur retail investors to become better investors. My guest today is Mohammed Ismail. He's head of fixed income at Mergence Investment Managers, and he has been in this position for 3 years. Before joining Mergence, he worked at Sanlam Investments, Momentum Investments, and Ashburton, and he also owns and manages Quantessential, and he's also the MD of Sagita Capital Management. And he's also on the verge of becoming an actuary. I believe he is writing the last actuarial exams in a few weeks. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us here in studio. First of all, tell us about your background. Where did you grow up and when were you first exposed to the investment world?
Morning, Rake, and thank you for having me. It's been a while since I think the sort of the early days of deciding what I want to do with my career and really kind of making, you know, the decision to sort of move into the sort of professional investing space. At the beginning of it all, I think, you know, my introduction to investments really didn't start with me. It started with my mom. You know, as a kid, you know, growing up, my mom was very sort of disciplined in the sense that, you know, she wanted to instill in all of us, my siblings, this sort of culture of saving. And at that time, you know, we were kids. My mom, you know, the traditional sort of products that were available were things like the unit trusts. And I still remember, I still had that account. It's with Old Mutual. But, you know, my mom set up 3 different accounts and she would contribute on a monthly basis. And she said, you know, when you turn 18, that account is yours.
Did she consult you or share with you the actual choices of unit trusts and investments?
To be honest, I wouldn't have really understood it. If you're young at that age, especially in your teens, you just know my mom is saving for me, you know. So the journey sort of to university, like kind of deciding what to study, I never really at least thought, okay, you know, I wasn't sort of on a sort of fast track to becoming, say, an investment professional. I had choices. I mean, to be honest, when I did start my university career, I had ambitions to study physics. And it's something that I still deeply, deeply sort of, you know, want to do at some point in my life. But I had to make a sort of decision to say, look, I need a career where I can utilize what I'm good at. I'm good at sort of solving problems. And it had to be something sort of business or sort of, you know, focused on, I wouldn't say investments, but somewhere in finance. Because I understood that, you know, the commercial world really, I mean, a lot of people, it's a competitive market. You know, we go in there and many succeed well, and many succeed, and they're generally just sort of happy with the success. So at a point in time, my dad kind of convinced me to say, leave the physics, leave the maths, focus on actuarial science. And in fact, actually, you know, I still remember the day my father was, you know, very adamant. He took me to university to make sure I register, because I registered for actuarial science because he knew me. I love physics. I still do, but he wanted me to do something more solid with my career.
But when you study actuarial science, I think the perception is when you start, you're going to have a career in the insurance industry. But more and more actuaries actually migrate to the investment side or into the asset management industry. When did you make that decision?
I think you're very right in the sense that when you start to learn what, for instance, actuarial science is about, and you start to sort of, you know, look at some of the different sort of problems that you're solving, it's very, I mean, it's a focus mainly on, you know, the insurance sort of industry, the insurance sort of focus problems. But you do one or two things. You pick up, like, in the different courses, you start to, like, work on investments. And I think investments start to be a little bit more attractive in the sense that you kind of understand that a lot better than some of the very esoteric topics in actuarial science, which can be quite difficult to grasp if, you know, you don't really have a full good understanding of the fundamentals. So in my 3rd year, for instance, in actuarial science, I decided, look, I've had enough, in a sense. For instance, I love stochastic calculus. as one of the topics we covered. And that was very sort of heavy in mathematics of finance. And then WITS offered this degree called Advanced Mathematics of Finance. And I'm like, no, that's what I'm going to go do, right? And when I had moved into sort of when I had registered for that honors degree, we cover a lot in risk, sort of risk management. We cover a lot in sort of understanding the derivative market, how to price, you know, a lot of these financial contracts. And then two sort of careers, like options started coming out. There was trading, there was portfolio management, there was sort of risk management, you know, working as an analyst. And all sort of within the sort of finance space. And I figured, you know what, I'm good at least in solving problems. I think quick on my feet. I have a fairly decent temperament when it comes to making decisions. We'll stick into it at least. I mean, trading sounds exciting. And that's how I started.
Were you ever a trader?
I was for Sanlam Capital Markets, yes, for about 5 years.
That's not easy to do. Were you good at it?
I would say we had our ups and downs. I don't want to boast to say that, you know, that I was making a profit every year. It was very difficult. I had good mentorship at least. And I worked with a good guy, Kopano Marko, who was at Mazi Capital. He sort of hired me. And for that 5 years that we worked together, I learned a lot from him. Especially like, you know, it's one thing to sort of understand how to value derivative. It's another thing to really manage risk, right? And that kind of also moves down into some my sort of like approach to, or philosophy, you want to call it, is that I don't approach investments in a way where I can't manage the risk. So I can't manage what I can't measure, essentially, right? That's very important.
Manage the risk. Just explain what that is and why that is important, because many of the other investment professionals I've interviewed in the past, they really go and look at numbers, they analyze the balance sheet and the income statement and the cash flow statements, and that's where they start. But you said you started with managing risk. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so in the context of your portfolio, right, you're going to make investment decisions or trading decisions. You're going to decide whether to buy or sell certain securities. And I'm going to talk about, for instance, say government bonds, right? I mean, I know that it's not sort of accessible to most, but let's use it as an example. When I talk about risk, right, I'm talking about what really is changing the value of what you are investing in. So the factors, the different factors, right? And, you know, given my sort of background, you know, you want to sort of put pen to paper and start to sort of put together a model or some sort of, you know, equation. And then, but that's very important in that if you understand what's driving the value, right, those factors, you really then understand the nature of how this thing, the value is going to change. If I take an equity, for example, yes, very much so. So certain portfolio managers, analysts like to do the sort of bottom up. They look at balance sheets, cash flow statements, etc. They're building some sort of models. And again, they're putting together some sort of equation. The inputs into that equation, and those inputs carry risk. So if you cannot understand those inputs, the risk of those inputs, if you don't measure it properly, you end up with like, you either get lucky, or most of the time, some guys aren't lucky. And I think, you know, when we're talking in this discussion, that's kind of the difference between your sort of investment professional versus your retail investor. In the sense that, you know, when someone, for instance, as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, go out when they finish sort of studying, they go and open an easy equities account, and they're like, okay, I'm ready to invest. And nothing stops them from buying what or selling what they want to. But then, you know, what really the problem is that do they understand the risk that they're taking? And that ultimately, if you don't have a good grasp or understanding on the risk, you're setting yourself up for failure.
How do you gauge the risk of an investment, especially if you're an amateur, not an actuary or a CA?
So it takes time. For instance, if you are someone who doesn't have any, call it like investment experience or even experience like trying to value something, because everything has a value. Some of the basic models that people would use for valuation is to say, okay, I understand that if I buy something, like for instance, if I put money into a fixed deposit, what am I going to get for it? I'm going to get periodic sort of interest. It's going to come either monthly or annually, etc. So there's something to gain from it, right? And of course, there is the value. I put, say, for instance, 100 Rand into the account. I want my 100 Rand to still be there in 1 year, 2 year, 5 years' time, right? So there must be some utility that this 100 Rand in this sort of vehicle must produce. And that utility is, of course, the interest, right? So in the context of like an investment, so if someone is going to buy, so for instance, a share, the first question is, before making any decision, is why is the value what it is I see in the newspaper, on screen, etc.? Why is that value and how do I get to that value? I think it's very important to start there. I mean, where did that value come from? then you get a sense of, okay, that value, you know, is potentially some sort of, I can see some summation of cash flows. What are those cash flows? So you start to dig deeper. It's an investigation. It's a journey. Once you get the principles sort of there, you're not going to like fully understand everything in the first sort of, you know, at first glance, but you're going to have a good grasp of it. And if you're someone that potentially, you know, hasn't got the time, or maybe you sort of, won't say lack understanding of it, but maybe you're just not getting it, there are different sort of access points that, you know, sort of you can invest without the worry of, do I need to understand this risk? But at the same time, you can start to build your education, build your intuition to maybe then eventually start to say, okay, I'm comfortable to maybe do this on my own with a small portion of my portfolio. I can split it into, this is now where I don't have to worry too much about, versus I can take a little bit of my own risk, well, at least understandable risk to, you know, meet an object.
Yeah, I would imagine experience plays a massive role in understanding risk. You know, if you've burnt your fingers once, you learn, and you learn a lot. And I think that has been a theme throughout this podcast series. But let's see how you put your theory into practice. When did you make your very first investment with money you have earned, and what was that investment?
So in university, again, you are studying, etc., but then certain opportunities do come up, especially for someone who has no idea as to like how these things work. So for instance, I borrowed money from my mom because MTN had this sort of nice sort of structure that they were proposing for the retail sort of market, and for 2,000 rand you could buy MTN shares. So I knew what MTN did as a company, etc. But, I mean, of course, you know, you're buying something. They're saying it's 2,000 Rand. You're going to get allocated so many number of shares. Where they got the value from, I don't know, right? It was just, you know, sort of the issue price. You see, and these are like you said, you learn from experience, the certain mistakes. I mean, in hindsight, was it a good thing to buy, you know, at that level? Yeah, for a while, I mean, you don't pay attention to it. And then suddenly you see some dividends come into your account. You're like, oh, okay, this thing is paying something. And then you go to the newspaper or the internet at that time. And you see, okay, the share price is this. And then you kind of see growth and you get excited. You see, well, it's gone up. Yeah, for my first investment really wasn't my own money. It was my mom who actually helped me with getting the cash. Subsequently, like through that, what I had done, to be honest, is kind of invest in myself. Like at university, I used to work part-time for a company. And the skill that I, where basically I taught myself how to program. Because at this company, I was doing some sort of work and it was very sort of analytical work, you know, on spreadsheets. And I thought, you know what, I can automate this. And I wrote some code, got it to work. And then I was earning quite well in doing a part-time job because I wasn't really doing the work anymore, that this program was doing it. And then I sold it. I sold it to the company that I was working for. And I used the cash to fund my studies. And then from there, it's like, okay, and then I thought, okay, I've sort of moved from, I've now sort of set this career now where I'm going to work in the quantitative analysis space. Ultimately, I want to get to, you know, the sort of objective of effectively, you know, being a trader or PM. And then, yeah, along the way, in terms of building a portfolio, I started off with my little unit trust account from my mom, got some shares in MTN, and this is where I burnt my fingers. So you're working now, and everyone is opening share trading accounts. And I was one of them. I'd admit I was one of them. And you know, you are focused on, okay, what stocks are doing well in the market. You want to own what the winners, and you don't really want to look at the losers. And at that time, there were many. There were Sanlams, there were a few. And without understanding risk, as I mentioned before, me that understood how to value derivatives thought, okay, I'm going to buy CFDs on Sanlam. Right? And then I burnt myself. So these sort of things, like, you know, you make mistakes only to learn from them. So the failure in that decision was more the fact that I did not know how a CFD actually worked. Yes, I can value the thing. But then when it comes to funding the position and really understanding, hey, I'm actually borrowing money and it's costing me to do that. Those are the risks I'm talking about. If you don't fully understand the big picture, right, you can easily get burnt.
Yeah, derivatives are risky products, and if you don't understand them, you know, it's inevitable that you will get burned.
The one thing I will say, for a person that understood derivatives, you can still get burned, because I mean, my training has been in how to value these things, and you can still get burned because it's the failure of understanding all the risks.
Do you still have the unit trust portfolio your mother gave you?
I do still have it. Yeah, I've not touched it. She's contributed to a certain point. I inherited the portfolio. In fact, when I did start, I mean, as a novice, because of that sort of culture my mom instilled in me, right? I could not at that point in time say, I'm going to do this professionally or for myself. I still was not confident because, like I said, I'm a very risk-averse person by nature, but also because of the fact that when you start to learn about these things, I mean, like the ways, like the values can change and the different factors, you start to be a little bit scared and that you don't understand. So when I started working, less so investing in my own sort of stocks, I actually put every month dedicatedly, I did open a unit trust with an Allan Gray or Coronation. And I think at that time, even allocating to the different sort of products they had, I did some work. I tried to figure out, okay, you know, what makes sense? I mean, I knew the sort of idea of, as a young person, you have this longer capacity to take risk, etc. So invest in equities. But I never understood equities. It's an asset class for me. You know, it's, although I understand the mechanisms behind things, it's not something I was too sort of pulled towards. I actually gravitated more towards fixed income. And I think it's more because of the quantitative part of that sort of asset class, right? Where it's a little bit more understandable. I can write the equations down. I can do certain things with it. I understand the inputs. I understand what's driving the value a lot more clearer than equities. Equities is a little bit more tricky.
So your current personal portfolio, let's talk about that. It's very interesting that you say that you rather look at fixed income. You're pretty young still, and most of the textbooks would tell you, listen, you need as much exposure to equities as long-term growth options. So how does your portfolio look?
I've got three different sort of, I call it different tiers, right, of sort of my savings / investments. I've got the usual sort of RA products, which I won't talk about that now. I've got some exposure to a few UTs, which basically we manage with Emergence. And then I've got the share portfolios where I've got sort of a domestic-only portfolio and I've got an offshore. So on the domestic side, generally, like I said, you know, with the equity market in SA, I don't fully understand. I mean, I do understand. It's just I'm not comfortable with the risks in SA at the moment. And this is a bit more broader speaking, right? So I don't actively invest in the local sort of equity market. On the offshore side, I've steadily, I'd say this, and I, you know, I'm just worried by saying this, I'm going to sort of contradict myself a bit. But like what I've done, where I was a bit more active in the offshore space was around the COVID sort of, you know, pandemic time, where there was a sort of thematic kind of, you know, sort of build up in the tech space. And then essentially I had some cash sitting offshore that was just pretty much earning a very flat interest rate. Then they cut rates dramatically. Now then, of course, now you're earning nothing. And then I kind of looked at the tech space and I saw things moving, you know, quite aggressively. And fortunately for me, I think I got in early. Now, whether that's just lucky, because, you know, kind of luck for me is preparation meeting opportunity, but that was just an opportunity where I think I was underprepared for. Because, you know, the fact that you understood at a very high level, okay, these tech companies are, I mean, everyone is sort of moved online, et cetera. You had a good sense that these companies were generally going to perform.
What did you invest in? Microsoft, Meta, Alphabet, NVIDIA?
At that time, general, so because I could not analyze companies. I mean, it's, be able to analyze companies, it takes time. So I didn't really do it on an individual stock basis. I actually was one of the people, and that's why I say I don't want to contradict myself here, but I was one of the people that bought into the idea of the ARK funds by Catherine Wood.
The?
ARK funds, yeah, okay. So these are like your innovation, your next generation type of companies that are doing, you know, R&D, etc. But like maybe tech focused, or like, for instance, they've got a fund where they do a lot of, you know, biotechnology, for instance, invest in biotech companies. There's a lot of active research happening there. So naively, if you just want to get exposure to something, right, there is a product called an ETF. And with the ETF, you don't have to worry about a lot of having to look at a stock individually and go and tear to pieces to really understand it. You're getting some broad level pooled risk sort of exposure. And when I say pooled, you know, there's some level of diversification in those products. That's what made them popular as well. The fact that, you know, it's not just a bunch of, like, say, five stocks put together. It's quite a broad-based list, and they have different levels of interaction. From that side, you kind of get this level of diversification. There's lower risk there, and it's kind of a hidden feature for you. So you're getting the benefit of getting exposure, and like I said, you know, you don't have to worry too much then about actually having to focus on the risk there. Like, not that you do still focus on risk, but not when you're looking at individual stocks.
Do you have, in your personal capacity, exposure to fixed income products?
I did, and I actually reduced it. But you see, fixed income products, they would vary. So in South Africa, we've got sort of bond ETFs, etc. But I feel that, okay, for what I do professionally, I worked in fixed income, right? So I know how to sort of construct a portfolio a lot better than an ETF, obviously, because ETF is just sort of tracking. For instance, if I get Mergence and the different asset managers that I worked at, we had the opportunity to invest in the funds that we manage. And, you know, I was very confident because I understood, I trusted my judgment for risk, and I also trusted kind of the models that I was putting together with a little bit of bias here and there. But, I mean, I had faith in, you know, what I was doing was more or less correct. So I do have exposure to that indirectly in the products that I do manage. And then, of course, you know, we can pick up fixed income exposure. I mean, in South Africa, we've got ETFs. We've got asset managers who have bond funds, for instance. The asset class that I really much prefer, like if you're looking to invest and you want to, I'd say, if you're worried about things like inflation, or you're worried about, you know, having to maintain that real purchasing power of your investments, you're worried about capital protection, income funds, for instance, or I wouldn't say money market, but in that space at least, where you are investing in products where the returns are a little bit more certain. You don't have to worry about, you know, am I going to see fluctuation in future returns? They're generally a lot more certain. And you're getting a return on that investment that is above, I wouldn't say substantially, but it's, you know, a modest amount above inflation. Something that equities can't consistently do. And you mentioned earlier, that, like, you know, when I was young, oh, I'm young now, why fixed income? Because it's an asset class that actually is providing a little more certainty in the outcome than a lot of the rest, the other asset classes.
If you could go back to Mohammed, the 21 or 22 year old, and give yourself advice, what would it be?
My advice would be stick with what I'm doing. I'm on the right path because I have no regrets on my journey so far. The one thing, like, I was consistent at, I mean, I love problem solving. But my nature is I like to look at everything. So I'm not just focused on, like, just working on investments and working on, like, kind of sort of this niche set of skills only within, say, fixed income or quants. Like I said, I always love physics. I actually like to apply things that are outside the domain of finance, so in finance. So, like, some of the stuff that I'm busy working on, actually, some of the models that I'm building to predict sort of yield curve behavior, I'm borrowing some of those concepts from physics. I'm borrowing it from different disciplines. I love to learn, and I like to sort of implement. So the one thing is, like, I learn a theory, but it's not good enough just being a theory. Let's put it into, I don't know, into some software. Like, you know, you could put it in Excel, you could put it into Python, etc., and do something with it.
So you never take a decision on a gut feeling?
Very seldom. It's very seldom. Because the thing is, I like to see data confirm either hypothesis. I wouldn't rely too much on, like, for instance, if I don't have enough data, it's very difficult to draw statistical sort of conclusions from it. So you want to generally have enough data, you want to have, but then obviously there's only so much that model or that sort of thing can take you. You have to inject some level of subjectivity. The market is very subjective. It's not like in physics where there's an equation for, say, motion, and it's absolute. I mean, if I apply this everywhere, I'm going to get the same number. The market is a very dynamic, changing people network. It's people emotions, it's people's behaviors, people's everything put together. No equation can define that. Mm-hmm. So you can try to strip out the noise. You can put something down. Like you said, I mean, theoretically, textbooks all say these asset classes behave this way in this sort of market environment. And we're not experiencing that now. South Africa is a good case where you see this. I mean, generally, bonds are meant to be a hedge against inflation, and, you know, when the economy sort of goes under. But what are we seeing? We're seeing the exact opposite. Things are moving in the same direction. You've got this concordance that is occurring. It's not even like, you know, things are changing. So the theory also has to change with it. It has to at some point. Portfolios, for instance, like the Farmer French model, talk about factor investing. I mean, the sort of results that have come out over the last 20 or 30 years in the sort of factor investing space is, I mean, compared to, like, the cap M and the sort of idea of more risk, you take high return, you find that for taking less risk, you're getting high return, which is, you know, the counterintuitive. But again, why is it doing that? Is because the market is sort of thinking that way.
Time is not on our side, but I need to ask you two more questions. And the first one would be, what has been the best investment you think you have ever made?
Okay, I'm going to say this. The best investment I ever made was studying for a master's degree in Singapore because I met my wife. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good investment.
Yes. So back in 2017, yeah, I decided I wanted a bit of international exposure. It cost me quite a bit of money. I did a master's degree in Singapore and I met my wife. And okay, so we got married in 2021, and yeah, that for me, I'd say, would be the biggest investment.
And then conversely, what has been the worst investment you have ever made?
There have been a few. Not everyone is successful. Personally, as I mentioned, you know, starting off, there was my CFD adventures, then also getting a little bit burnt in the algorithmic FX space. So I was one of the victims. I don't know if people can remember back in 2016, there was this sort of flash crash with the British pound. So my brother and I, my brother's quite tech savvy, so he got me involved in the sort of algorithmic FX sort of space. So, you know, he showed me the software, he showed me how to sort of think about writing the algos, and we experimented. We tried different things. Now, obviously, like, I mean, we know markets are inefficient, right? So, you know, when we were looking at certain currencies to trade, we would look for how these currencies gap, we look for liquidity, we look for a lot of things. And then we started to put together trading rules based on those things, and especially when the markets open, when they close, etc. We looked at a lot of factors. Anyway, I was running a strategy on the British pound at the time, and I looked at the portfolio at night. It was up, you know, quite a bit, and I thought, okay, fine. Yeah, like any other night, happy, went to bed. And then I woke up like in the early morning to only to see my account actually wiped out, and I had like a massive margin call on the account. Mm. And then when I saw the actual sort of flash crash on that, it was just like, it just shows you that certain things are outside of your control. You may think you are sort of, you know, have a handle and everything else, but there can be things that can literally just happen where unforeseen things that you can't control for, they can essentially, you know, just, you know, wipe you out completely.
Mohammed, thank you so much for coming in today and for sharing your story and insights. And I'm sure they are, well, I've picked up a few golden nuggets of wisdom, which I will try and apply. I'm not an actuary, but I think you've got a very methodical and scientific approach to investments, and I think it's a good one to copy. So thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
That was Mohammed Ismail. He's head of fixed income at Mergent Investment Management.
Show me the money.
That was the Money Web, Be a Better Investor podcast with Rick Van Niekerk. Thanks for listening. Catch up and listen to all the MoneyWeb podcasts on moneyweb.co.za or the app. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.